Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. There are now more low-cost green options to get around the city of Stockton. The Stockton Mobility Collective unveiled new services, which include over 100 electric bikes, zero-emission cars, and online ticketing services for San Joaquin Regional Transit District buses, also known as RTD for short. Stockton, which historically has some of the poorest air quality in our region, as well as transportation and mobility challenges, is now getting services that many other large cities like Sacramento have had for quite some time. Funding for the new transportation options comes from grant money, and the hope is to expand these services after organizers get a better sense of how many people use the cars and the bikes in the community. Joining us now to talk about the new transportation services in Stockton are Diane Nguyen and Christine Corrales with the San Joaquin Council of Governments. Good morning.
Good morning, Vicky.
Well, Diane, I want to start with you. Let's begin with what some of the transportation or the mobility issues people in Stockton have traditionally faced and the need for these options, the new options that we're going to be talking about.
With the San Joaquin Council of Governments, one of our core mission is to provide safe, efficient, and equitable transportation, as well as choices for our residents. The challenges we have is to offer that to everyone in our community in a way where they can have access and in a way where it can be affordable.
What excites you about the new options that are rolling out?
I'm excited because it is a modern marvel here in San Joaquin. It gives disadvantaged communities choices so that they can have a larger radius to go to school, to find jobs, as well as improve the quality of life and hopefully secure living wages for the families.
Christine, talk to us about the San Joaquin Council of Governments and its role in this program.
So San Joaquin Council of Governments is leading as the lead agency for this project. The Stockton Mobility Collective includes multiple programs, and we can't implement any of these programs without some of our partners here in Stockton. And so SJCOG's role is really to help administer the funds that CARB has awarded to the region, track our progress on the project, and really help support this wide project team in bringing these services to the Stockton community.
And CARB is the California Air and Resources Board?
Yes, that's correct.
So I would imagine, Christine, this is in response to the San Joaquin area has long had some of the poorest air quality in our area. So I would imagine you're hoping this new initiative and this funding would help curb air pollution.
Yeah, that's exactly what we're trying to do with the Stockton Mobility Collective. With the programs that we're implementing in Stockton, we're putting an emphasis on providing clean transportation options. And we believe that offering electric pedal assist bike share and electric car share can really help reduce our dependence on fossil fuels. And as you mentioned, Vicky, Stockton and San Joaquin County experience some of the worst air quality in the nation. And so by expanding access to zero emission transportation options, especially in impacted communities like South Stockton, the project is really directly contributing to better air quality while also providing meaningful mobility access in these communities.
Diane, why has it taken this long to add these greener options for public transit to get people out of their cars and using e-bikes or even improving RTD buses?
I think that this modern perspective has come into San Joaquin County at this time because of opportunities at the state. You mentioned earlier about the Air Resources Board and the grant funding. I think in my experience, this is the first time of this level of infusion of millions of dollars to support and transform communities.
All right, so let's get into some of the package of the transportation options. Christine, I mean, let's talk about the car share program. How does that work?
Yeah, so the car share program is run by Mio Car, and it's a 100% electric vehicle car sharing service that's now available in Stockton. In order to participate, a member of the public must be at least 21 years old and have a valid driver's license, a relatively clean driving record, and then a valid form of payment. And then to sign up, you could fill out an application on the on miocar.org, or you could also download their app from your mobile phone app store.
And so how does it work? Do residents need to essentially pick it up or drop it off at a certain location, or is there a boundary?
So we have a defined boundary in the city of Stockton. However, we do have three stations now online. We're really proud of our partnership with the Housing Authority of the County of San Joaquin. And so as of April 1st, we have three stations online in partnership with them at Conway Homes Apartments in South Stockton, Victory Gardens also in the southern part of the city and region, as well as Grand Canal, which is more of a central location in the city of Stockton, right off of I-5.
Got it. And that's just one piece of this broader initiative. Diane, talk to us about the e-bikes that are rolling out in Stockton.
Well, the significance of the e-bikes is that we are looking to provide a connection to what's called the first and last mile of transit. You mentioned earlier the San Joaquin Regional Transit District is a project partner. And one of the challenges of individuals using public transit is the question of how do they get to a bus and what happens when the bus drops them at a stop that is a little further from their ultimate destination. The electric bikes are geared to address that last connection to everyone's destination.
And the Bike Share program is a nonprofit, correct?
Correct.
So it's known as Bike Stockton. How is it different opposed to other companies like Lime or Uber?
I'm not sure that it's significantly different. With this nonprofit model, we are trying to achieve the same thing, which is providing transportation choices to residents. The significance of the nonprofit model is this demonstration project is a work in progress. We're going to identify the demand and be able to tweak the locations of the bikes, as well as learn more on how the bikes are being used in order to customize a transportation solution ultimately for the Stockton area.
Got it. Okay, Christine, so that brings me to the third part of this. How is the Mobility Collective in Stockton making it easier for residents to actually take public transit in terms of buses?
So one of the components of the Stockton Mobility Collective is that we're building on an app that SJCOG has already developed and made available to the public. It's called the Vamos Mobility app. This app currently, it provides the functionality for a rider of transit, someone who's exploring their transit options, to be able to plan their trip as well as pay for their tickets online or through the app, and then also ride the systems by just showing their tickets to the various operators in San Joaquin County. So with the grant funding from the California Air Resources Board, we've actually been able to improve some of the usability of this app to help transit riders also discover other options. So right now in the Vamos app, you're able to download from your smartphone app store, and you will now see the car share and the bike share options on the map as you're exploring your options. So this is one way where we are hoping that those who already depend on our transit system are also becoming exposed and learning kind of passively in the app about additional options that are being made available in Stockton.
That's awesome. Finally, Christine, I mean, what's the next milestone? I imagine you'd like to scale this up in the future.
That's definitely one of our long-term goals, but in the immediate, I will say that just this last weekend on April 1st, SJCOG and its partners celebrated the official launch of these programs in Stockton, and so we were really excited to see the community come out and help celebrate these new programs in our city. So over the next couple of months, our outreach team is actually going to be very active in our community, bringing these resources and information out to where community members gather and come together. And so Our big milestone in the coming months is really to get those memberships and signups up so that we can understand that there's strong interest in these programs, and we'll have kind of a base user base that can give us feedback on how these programs are working for them and how we can make them better for the future. Because in the long run, we do hope to learn and expand the impact and positive energy of these programs throughout Stockton and the rest of the region.
Christine and Diane, thanks for laying everything out for us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Diane Nguyen and Christine Corrales are with the San Joaquin Council of Governments. Up next, we'll learn how the fentanyl crisis is impacting Native American and Indigenous communities across the state, as well as solutions that are taking shape at the state capitol. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Fentanyl is a pain medication prescribed after major surgery or during advanced stage cancers. It is up to 50 times more potent than heroin and up to 100 times stronger than morphine. But the illegal production of this synthetic opioid is fueling a rise in overdose deaths across the country, and that includes California. Fentanyl is often unknowingly laced with counterfeit prescription pills like Xanax or Percocet, as well as recreational drugs. Since it's so potent, just a small amount can have deadly consequences. This is why the DEA warns one pill can kill. But although awareness into what is now a full-on epidemic is widespread, solutions to curb this crisis are challenging, especially in the most vulnerable and historically neglected communities. A roundtable at the state capitol listened to tribal communities across the state who are pleading for resources. The most recent complete data from 2020 shows Native American and Indigenous people had the highest opioid-related overdoses in California, and signs indicate that illicit fentanyl use has surged even higher over the past year. So we're going to spend some time understanding why. Starting off our conversation is Kate Wolf, CAP Radio's healthcare reporter. Good morning, Kate.
Good morning, Vicki.
So you have joined us in the past. You've been following how the fentanyl crisis is unfolding across communities in Northern California. Your latest series of reports is focusing on how this epidemic is impacting Native American communities. How did you come to better understand what they're collectively grappling with?
Right. So I'm relatively new to the healthcare beat, but I came from San Francisco, where the fentanyl crisis has been openly playing out on the streets. And as a reporter, I spoke to a lot of people who told me that fentanyl is everywhere. People get into it because they get hooked on prescription opioids, or they're exposed to it in other drugs, as you mentioned, what they think are prescription pills, but are have fentanyl in them. In the efforts of, I really have started to figure out more about how this is affecting Native American communities because of the efforts of Assemblymember James Ramos, who's from the San Bernardino area and was elected in 2018 as the first Native American person to California state legislature. And he's really been trying to highlight Native issues among his colleagues in the legislature. He got there to be funding for outreach to Native communities regarding 988, which is the crisis line, which we're going to talk about later. And he also convened a roundtable regarding fentanyl in tribal communities last week.
It's not that it's new that the statistics in Indian country are surpassing others in the state of California. It's always been that way. And it's always been felt that we've been left on our own to deal with our own problems. right? Now, by having a representation in the state legislature and being able to assert ourselves, representation truly does matter. Now we're forming alliances because now the rest of the world, if you will, is now being exposed to what's truly going on within Indian country.
And those alliances that he's talking about are with other members of the legislature, and they're also with mental health services. And so during the roundtable last week, there was a lot of discussion about what is really going on within Indian country. And a lot of that is that there's an insidious agent of fentanyl and opioid abuse affecting people of all ages.
Yeah, you're talking about a 988 summit as well as a roundtable. So these are two really big recent developments that are taking place in Sacramento. When it comes to that roundtable, which was held at the state capitol, what did you learn?
So there were three elements to the roundtable, which was focused on how the legislature could help Indian country and Native American people living in urban areas. There were friends and family impact statements, law enforcement and education perspectives, and healthcare perspectives. And a lot of the experts who spoke described having direct experience with losing someone to fentanyl. More than half had lost a direct family member. Here's Yurok Tribal Police Chief Greg O'Rourke.
I still had that stigma attached to it of, well, they shouldn't have started using. And it wasn't until my sister died of an overdose when that shift of perspective became very personal and very relevant.
And Chief O'Rourke works with the sheriff out there in Del Norte County to respond to this. They have a positive relationship, which is not always the case between tribal police and local sheriffs. That was one of the issues that was discussed needed to be bolstered to respond both to instances of overdoses, but also to the influx of drugs, of fentanyl and opioids into tribal communities. O'Rourke said that they can do better with educating people about these drugs, educating people about harm reduction, and with getting people into services immediately when they need them. I also learned about what this is looking like among young people on tribal lands, and it's super pressing. One of the speakers was Amy Admire, who's been teaching on the Rincon Indian Reservation in San Diego County. So we were talking about the Yurok tribe up in Northern California.
Far, far northwest corner of the state along the Pacific Ocean, just south of Oregon.
Exactly, exactly. And Amy Admire, who's speaking down from San Diego County, she's been working there for decades. And she says, we know about the school to prison pipeline, where students are over-policed, pushed out of school into the juvenile justice system, taught that school isn't really meant for them. But she says that they're seeing an emerging trend, which is the school to addiction pipeline, where young people who are Native, who are discriminated against at school, who are under or miseducated or, you know, not thought to be worthy of investment, get involved with drugs.
Opiates such as fentanyl saturate our communities. Our children tell us they are everywhere. And we have eighth graders with opioid problems exacerbated by the pandemic. We know they're not returning to school.
So Admire, you can hear the emotion in her voice. It's really personal. She's seeing this every day. She's really on the front lines. And she wants to see schools provide more equitable education to Native students and enforce existing California laws that are meant to support them. So Admire came with a list of more specific recommendations that she issued to lawmakers. So this conversation is really just getting started. It's really getting in front of legislators. There's some stuff in the legislature that is like harm reduction elements there. It's a little bit piecemeal, but she's really saying we need more regulation in the schools.
Yeah, I mean, Kate, you mentioned that there's existing legislation, but obviously this roundtable is highlighting that there are gaps in actually making that legislation effective. And there's also talks of more legislation and bills moving through the legislature this session. Given that California is home to the most tribes in the country, what did you learn about these challenges when it comes to responding in the immediacy of an overdose, but also long-term in prevention?
In terms of long-term prevention, I think it connects to what Admire was saying with education of people of all ages, right? Young people up to elders. We know that elders are all, you know, Native communities are also losing elders to the to fentanyl. And mental health support, which I know we'll get into in this conversation, is so necessary. In terms of immediacy, it can be really dire in these rural areas. A lot of the tribes are in very far far-flung places. And that there's, of course, a huge historical context for that of being pushed to far-flung lands. Angela Elliott Santos is the chairperson of the Manzanita Band of the Kumeyaay Nation near the state's border with Mexico. And she says when someone's in danger there, there's only one deputy who responds.
If you call and it's in the night, no one comes for 2 or 3 hours. There are no PERT teams. There are no mental health crisis teams. But maybe through collaboration in those rural areas, we could serve not only our people, but the other people who are also suffering in that area.
And when she says PERT team there, she's talking about psychiatric emergency response teams, which are often desired in crisis situations over police because they can provide de-escalation and appropriate mental health support. And the need for regional solutions were echoed by, a very famous tribal chief who came, Yurok Tribal Court Chief Judge Abby Abendanti, who's the first tribal woman to pass the state bar and become a judge in California.
Now, we cannot ignore this. And we need to be in partnerships with our natural partners. And that means law enforcement. It means health services. It means we need mobile clinics in rural areas. We need regional treatment centers, not treatment centers that we have to go hundreds of miles to that may not have room for us. This is not right. This is a state that can do better and needs to do better.
And that was something that many speakers brought up, which was that there's a need for increased, consistent funding for tribes in the state.
We're talking about fentanyl specifically, but tied to this, of course, is a conversation about mental health. Last year, there was the official rollout of 988. That is a suicide and crisis lifeline. It's an easier number, and it was rebranded from the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. And there was a summit about this, specifically when it pertains to matters of Native American and Indigenous people, and it was held in Sacramento, specifically to highlight barriers. What did you take away from the conversations there?
So I learned that the 988, since it rebranded, calls have increased. So people who are in crisis, people who are have a family member or friend in crisis are calling about 22%. They're increased 22% in the 6 months following the change to 988 compared to the 6 months before. But D.D. Hirsch Mental Health Services, which is the largest provider of crisis counseling in the state, they said that they know that they need to be doing more to serve Native people. Native American people are the second highest rates of suicide in the state, and they account for about 1% to 2% of California's population. About less than 1% of the calls to 988 were from Native people. And they know that more needs to be done both on their side, on the crisis counseling side, to provide cultural competency, to provide cultural humility, a term that Virginia Hedrick taught me, who's going to join us later. To help people in their crisis, that people who know about their backgrounds, who know about their belief systems, who can really guide them in a way that's sensitive. And then on the tribal side, there needs to be more done to lower stigma and ensure that people feel comfortable calling and people feel like they can actually be helped there. So it was a really powerful convening and really brought home how integrated traditional cultural elements are in mental health and in healing. And the summit started off with a really beautiful traditional song led by Elder Mary Tarongo and Raquel Williams from Wilton Rancheria. And they described that the song is meant to invoke Moloku, the eagle, who brings you down into the valley, but also up onto the mountaintops.
Hey, yo, we know. Hey, yo, we know. Hey, yo, we know.
And you're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. If you're just joining us, we're learning how the fentanyl crisis is impacting Native American communities across California. We're now going to bring in an important perspective. Virginia Hedrick is a member of the Yurok Tribe and the executive director of the California Consortium for Urban Indian Health, which does advocacy on behalf of health clinics and treatment facilities in the state. Thank you for making the time, Virginia.
Squeanakoi, Nacnow, Virginia, Hedrick, Shregon, Mewa, Mecha. Good morning. My name's Virginia. I come from the village of Shregon. It's good to be here.
Thank you for taking the time. We were just talking about a roundtable that was held at the state capitol, as well as a summit highlighting the barriers to the 988 crisis lifeline. I mean, both of these conversations are really focused on improving resources and access to Native American communities across the state. And we just heard candid emotional responses that are profound and I'm sure quite familiar to you as well. What are you seeing on the front lines that people need to better understand?
Yeah, I think, there's a lot to that. You know, something that I said in both places, and I can summarize better here, is as Indian people, we every day walk in two worlds. One world, which is this very Western sort of colonized world. And then the other world is our traditional realm, our cultural realm. And so when we think about solutions and we think about how to address these issues, we have to have a solution and a response that comes from both places. And so in terms of 988, you know, 988 can be a really critical resource for communities like the Native American community, like my community, like other Black and Brown communities who have historically not been able to rely on emergency services like 911. 988, you know, I have a lot of hope for it that if properly built, if properly supported, and with this realm of being able to answer and respond to calls with a sense of cultural humility and a sense of cultural competency, you know, can be a really a positive piece. In terms of the fentanyl and the opioid crisis, this is something, you know, substance use disorder has been impacting our communities for far too long. And we've been working to address it with extremely limited funding and a very underfunded system. The Indian healthcare delivery system here in California is grossly underfunded, both on the urban side and on the tribal side. The state of California went 12 years with no funding to the state Indian health program. It was only restored by a push by Assemblymember James Ramos to reinstate the state Indian health program, which is the first consistent funding to go back out to Indian health programs. And it was only refunded for a three-year period. So we're coming into this crisis into a very underfunded system and a system that doesn't well account for offering traditional healing services or cultural services. We're really fortunate that the state of California included in its larger CalAIM initiative the ability for Indian health programs to bill for traditional healing services through substance use disorder. But that portion wasn't approved by our federal partners at CMS. So we're still waiting for what, you know, as Indian country, we have a lot of the solutions. We just need the right support. We need the right funding, and we need agencies, government and federal agencies, to really come in and trust that we know what we're doing.
How much of a game changer was it to have Assemblymember Ramos in the state legislature, who is the first Native American to be a state lawmaker in California history?
Yeah, I mean, I think the really critical thing about having Assemblymember Ramos is he's the first California Native American. So he's the first person from a member of a California tribe who has that perspective of what we've experienced in terms of historical trauma, ongoing trauma. So we often hear talking about historical trauma like, oh, well, this was something that happened only 150 years ago. But it's really important to know that there's been ongoing trauma perpetrated by state, county, and federal governments in a number of ways. We see it right now with the MMIW crisis, which is so uniquely tied to the opioid crisis, to the fentanyl crisis, and to the shortage of proper health services. So having Assemblymember Ramos in place has given all of Indian country access to a state lawmaking process that we've never had before.
Yeah. When you bring up the missing and murdered Indigenous people crisis, and you say that it is tied obviously to overdoses and drug addiction as well, mental health more broadly, there are jurisdictional challenges. You have tribal land, you have county sheriff, you have federal law enforcement, and these create really dire gaps that cost lives at the end of the day when it comes to Native and Indigenous people. When it comes to the fact that we're home to the most tribes in the country, we're talking about land that can be very remote in Del Norte County. We're also talking about Wilton Rancheria, which is located in the Sacramento area. How does the location of tribes shape the response or lack thereof?
Yeah, I mean, I think location has a deep impact, but it's also the general invisibility of American Indian people in the state of California. You know, the highest population of American Indian Alaska Natives in the state of California live in an urban environment. And recent studies have shown that we experience the highest rates of racial misclassification. So in terms of healthcare, which is really my purview, you know, when we go to a hospital, we can be racially misclassified up to 60% of the time. And that happens if we phenotypically appear white or Black, or if we come with a Hispanic surname, probably tied to a genocide of the mission system here in California. If any of those things are present, we're going to be classified as a race other than American Indian, even if it's not our primary identifying race. And so, you know, I'm always deeply concerned when we know that the current data shows that we're dying at rates six times that of our non-Hispanic white counterparts when it comes to opioids, and we haven't factored in that we are racially misclassified on our death certificates. So the disparity is even deeper than we see it, but we absolutely are feeling it in Indian country. I mean, Kate said it perfectly earlier, you know, more than half of the people in the roundtable had somebody, myself included, who have lost somebody to fentanyl, who knows somebody in the hospital to fentanyl. That's more rare. And I shared that, you know, and this is true for other communities of color. We don't call 911, so uniquely tied to 988. So when we have somebody experiencing an overdose, we don't call for support because we don't know who's going to show up and we don't know if anyone will even come. And to the chairwoman's point, it might be 2 or 3 hours later. So what's the point? So when you look at opioid related deaths for American Indians, we top the chart. We're on the bottom when it comes to hospitalizations and ER visits. We don't get help. We just die.
When you bring up 988, that is a new addition in terms of the rebranding and making it easier for people to remember the number, literally. But there are obviously these unique cultural barriers that make access very difficult when it comes to people who live on tribal land or who are Native American and Indigenous. Is there a state, because 988 is national, so is there a state elsewhere in the country that is more of a gold standard in addressing cultural barriers, especially when it comes to tribal lands?
Yeah, Washington State has a line called Natives Helping Natives. And when you call 988 with a Washington State area code, you can press 4 to reach their line. In the state of California, I think we're inching our way close. And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that at Tsukuli, we host the CalHope Red Line, which we're a Native-run organization, offering a crisis line Monday through Friday, 9 to 5, for folks in our community who are experiencing distress. It was launched primarily related to COVID-19, but we're getting calls of all ages, with a special emphasis on our elder population, who have felt really isolated and really just need somebody to talk to. And we're able, through our red line, to transfer calls or get them access to services if needed. It's not a 988 response. It's not funded at that level, and it's not by design. I also wanted to address something you said earlier about the complexity of jurisdiction in Indian country. That's not by mistake. It's by design. Indian country was absolutely designed to be left out of government-funded services. And so as we re-navigate these waters, we can't enter them as though that there was a mistake or it all just fell together this way. This is absolutely by colonial design.
Are there specific pieces of policy that are making its way through the state capitol that give you some optimism or some level of assuredness that it's going to improve and things will change?
Yeah, I mean, Assemblymember James Ramos is championing some really important bills, including one that would allow tribal officers the access to the CLET system so they could properly look up potentially dangerous people on tribal lands and have a better understanding of what they've been involved in the past. There's a current request from California tribes to fund a $200 million initiative to address MMIP. And then we continue to push for harm reduction efforts. We know that when folks feel supported, no matter where they're at in their substance use disorder journey, their likelihood of staying alive and knowing that their life is valued goes far up. And I can think of countless examples of people who simply by not using alone, simply by having Narcan ready. And we have really dangerous other drugs. And panelists mentioned that too, that, you know, there's other drugs that are coming in that are not going to respond well to Narcan, if at all. So we continue to enter really dangerous waters.
Mm-hmm. On an individual level, you know, mental health has long had a stigma, right? Reaching out for help. This is across the country. It goes back generations and decades. Is that changing within Native American communities, reaching out, asking for help?
Yeah, I think it's a slow course of change, but there's many, many of us who have been really working to destigmatize access to mental health, destigmatize drug use, and really have real conversations about root causes, historical trauma. And so I do think it's slowly changing. I'm a mother of five kids, and I see it in my own kids, that their beliefs, the way they talk about accessing mental health, the way that they share that they need help is incredible. It's incredible. And I know the difference between me and my parents. So I think we're getting there. We're in an era of healing, but we can't let up now. We have to keep pushing.
Virginia, thank you so much for the time.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Virginia Hedrick is a member of the Yurok Tribe and the executive director of the California Consortium for Urban Indian Health, which does advocacy on behalf of health clinics and treatment facilities in the state. Kate, thank you for joining us as well.
Yes, happy to be here. Thanks.
And Kate Wolf, of course, is Cap Radio's healthcare reporter, and we're discussing how the fentanyl crisis and overall mental health is impacting Native American communities across California, as well as some promising solutions that are taking shape at the state capitol. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. While the impacts of a wet season in California are far-reaching, on the problematic end, it can be dangerous and destructive. But water is essential to supplying some 40 million Californians with everyday necessities, as well as bolstering the state's billion-dollar agricultural industry. But we're going to turn our attention to perhaps an easily overlooked benefit to a winter season that is rivaling decades past. The Yolo and Sutter bypasses were designed for flood control, diverting water, and in turn creating a floodplain. It's great for us humans, but it is a feast for wildlife. You may notice the coating of migratory birds that take a much-needed break on their annual journey, known as the Pacific Flyway. But it's easy to miss what's underneath the water. Millions of juvenile salmon that are bulking up for a years-long journey to the Pacific Ocean and come back to the freshwater to spawn. This is something that Carson Jeffries knows very, very well. He's a fishery scientist at the UC Davis Center for Watershed Sciences and joins us with more. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So Carson, I've been told, I guess a little bird told me, you are a fish whisperer.
Wow. Yeah.
Where did your passion begin?
I grew up in North Idaho fishing. And when I got to UC Davis as an undergrad, I realized that that's really what I wanted to do. And so I followed that path, and here I am 25 years later studying fish in California.
Yeah, what keeps you doing it? More than two decades later, researching fish.
It's just so interesting. I feel every time we go out, we learn something new, and I think the science that we're doing is relevant, and it's helping guide management in California.
Oh, yeah. So we're really focusing in on salmon for this conversation. What's so special about salmon in California?
Salmon in California are really interesting because we're at the southern end of their distribution. So we're at the very edge of where they live in the Pacific. And so because of that, we have very unique fish. We have four runs of Chinook salmon in California, which is different than anywhere else in their distribution in the Pacific. And so we have a very intimate kind of, I think, kind of cultural respect for them. And they've diversified throughout the state, but they're struggling.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that we're working on.
Yeah. And they've been struggling for years now. For those unfamiliar with the Yolo Bypass and the Sutter Bypass, what area are we talking about?
So the Yolo and Sutter Bypasses are both on the Sacramento River. So if you drive from Davis to Sacramento, you drive over the Yolo Bypass. And oftentimes, most of the year, it looks like agricultural fields. It's rice, it's wetlands. And then now you drive over it and it looks like a big lake. And there's so much water that comes out of the Sacramento River. And that's really what saved Sacramento. The city of Sacramento wouldn't be here without the Yolo and Sutter bypasses that reroute the water around that river.
And how far up does the Sutter Bypass go?
The Sutter Bypass goes up to Colusa. So it's up at the Sutter Buttes, and it starts coming out of the Sacramento River around this town of Colusa. And then it bypasses all the way down and then comes back into the Sacramento River by where the Feather River comes in.
So we're talking about a pretty large area. Is the Yolo and the Sutter Bypass, is this unique to California, or are there other areas in the states that are similar?
It was kind of accidentally the pioneer of that, in that when originally the levee and flood control system in the Sacramento Valley was put up, it was just levees next to the river. And that was really designed on how the Mississippi was controlled. And it realized quickly that that wasn't going to work and we needed to do something else. Hmm. And so that's how we ended up with the Yolo and Sutter bypasses.
So where did the bypasses fit into salmon migratory paths?
Yeah, it's really interesting. So baby salmon are born higher up in the rivers and they take this path down the Sacramento River. It's like a freeway for them, and that they're going down that freeway. And then these bypasses and the other floodplains are like bed and breakfasts for them on that migration out. And it's a place where they can stop, they can get some food, they grow really fast, and they keep on going on their way out to the ocean.
Hmm. So what is the big headline for this winter? How are salmon doing, juvenile salmon?
We are out looking in the rivers, and we're looking on the floodplains, and we're seeing nothing but big, fat salmon. These are the salmon that you really want to see, and that these are likely the salmon that we would have seen historically before we put levees on the river and kind of divorced the floodplain from the river.
Huh. Why do juvenile salmon do better and grow faster in a floodplain?
So when the water spreads out and goes out across this floodplain, it actually slows down. So if you drive over the Yolo Bypass, it's hard to see that the water is even moving.
Right.
But if you drive over the Sacramento River, it looks like a current that's going by. And what happens is that water slows down, it settles out. So the sediment in there settles out. You have lots of photosynthesis. You have lots of zooplankton and phytoplankton, and the fish just gorge on that food. There's about 100 times more food in the Yolo Bypass than there are. It's a little warmer. And then the fish grow about 8 times faster on the Yolo Bypass than they do in the river.
Wow, 8 times faster. So I imagine that bodes well when they head to the Pacific Ocean and then they got to come back.
Yeah, really. I mean, this is packing their lunch for the big ocean. In that the larger they are when they enter the ocean, the higher the likelihood of them coming back as adults.
Hmm. Was all of this, I mean, obviously the bypasses were created for flood control, right? So humans did this, but was this an unintended benefit to flood control?
Yeah, this is. I mean, we didn't plan this. This was solely done for our benefit for the cities of California and the Central Valley. And what we've seen is that these same working lands, lots of them are agricultural lands, end up, because they're not in production in the wintertime, and that they end up being really beneficial for the salmon during that time. And it just, we let it happen. And, you know, it doesn't happen all the time. And we're trying to figure out how to make that happen more frequently and better than maybe, because it wasn't the original plan. Can we do better?
Hmm. Yeah. What are we learning from the Sutter and Yolo bypasses and basically this kind of symbiotic relationship with wildlife when during a really robust wet season to apply across the state?
So it's these systems, you know, because we, like you just said, they weren't planned for fish. And it's been this kind of cooperation between a bunch of different groups. We have Ducks Unlimited, we have California Trout, we have the California Rice Commission, and these are all groups that historically didn't work together because we didn't see how that overlap on the landscape worked. But it's really been this place where we realized that we can work together. And we're working on prescribing how we can work with farmers and give them a prescription on how they could manage their lands better for salmon, or working with the waterfowl communities to see how we can use those same habitats for waterfowl and for fish and farms and fish and make that all work together. Because when we spend all this time fighting, is nothing actually ends up happening. I think we've really taken some steps forward in the last decade in making a place where we can make it work better. And there are. We've working with the agencies. Yellow Bypass there's a current change in how water flows into the Yellow Bypass. And that's really being championed by the Department of Water Resources. And so we have this big group and coalition that's really going to make these things happen more frequently.
When talking about how, you know, the salmon, at least the juvenile salmon, are looking great, I mean, this comes at a time when there's near record low numbers of some salmon-run Chinook runs in California. I mean, even California Department of Fish and Wildlife, there is heavily restrictions or even a ban on commercial salmon fishing from Oregon down to the California-Mexico border due to these near record low numbers. That may be hard for people to understand. Like, we have record low numbers right now, but as it stands in our bypasses, we have really big, healthy juvenile salmon.
Yeah, and it's a disconnect with how salmon, because they do spend years out in the ocean, is that the fish that are being caught now were fish that left during the drought. And during the drought, we really don't have any access to floodplains. Migratory conditions are really low and warm and full of predators. And we see these wet years are a real boost. And we've really been relying on our wet years that happen every 3 to 5 years to sustain our population. And by working with all these other groups, is we're working to try and make those wet years, or what happens during those wet years, happen even not in the floods, but just during the regular years and even during the low water years. Can we still get some of those processes where we see the fish can grow and sustain this, a commercial and recreational fishery and water usage? These are all things that are really dependent upon having a healthy salmon population.
So the healthy salmon we're talking about today will return in a couple years.
They return about 2 to 3 years on average.
So just like with California and climate and weather, there are these dramatic pendulum swings from 1 year to the next, or 1 year and a couple years later. I mean, there's really this kind of climate whiplash that's impacting salmon. Can we strike a better balance to hopefully even it out?
I don't think we're ever going to even out climate whiplash. I think we are subject to it. And, we have more control over the dry years. It's the wet years where we really don't have any control over. And I think setting ourselves up for having opportunities during those dry years and making sure that we have a safe flood control system that works during those wet years as well, because it's all of these parts. And we have to take advantage of both the dry years and the wet years and make sure it's going, because I think that's our future. And that's what the models seem to tell us.
And that makes your research so important. I mean, you were talking to me yesterday that you look at the lens of an eye of a fish to pretty much get a diet journal.
Yeah, it is really interesting. After the fish come back and they spawn and they die after they spawn, and we go out and collect their eyes, which I realize how weird that sounds. But they tell us a whole bunch about what that fish did during its life. And so we can get whether they used floodplains as juveniles, or whether they were in the river, or how they use these different habitats throughout their life. And that tells us a story about what they've done in the past and what habitats were important for them and how they ultimately bring us the fish that we either rely on in the ocean for the fishery, or the ones that come back and spawn and create the next generation.
Given that California, and we've been learning about this week, yesterday we were talking about the Tulare Basin. I mean, California doesn't have a lot of native floodplains anymore due to water infrastructure and water needs across the state for Californians. But what I'm hearing from you is there's also a benefit to having floodplains to humans as well when it comes to, the dangers that come from having too much water.
Yeah, it's a double-edged sword by having lots of water in these wet years. As we're realizing now, we see flooding in the Tulare Basin. We've seen levee failures in various systems. And I think it really highlights this multiple benefit of having these large flood control structures that have an ecosystem benefit as well. Is that when levees fail and lands are flooded, there's a big cost to that. And, one of the best mitigations for that, particularly if what we see in an ever-changing climate with more extreme precipitation events, are having floodplains that really have the ability to reduce that flood risk, but then also have this added benefit of having ecosystem function. You know, we're seeing the curtailment of the salmon fishery is a, you know, curtailing almost a $1 billion industry. And that ends up being really big. Those aren't small numbers. And so when you add up the human cost of flooding of houses and agricultural land, as well as the loss of the environmental cost for either fisheries or native fish that are returning, it ends up being substantial.
Carson, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you.
When I drive over the causeway or the Yolo bypass, I'm going to look at it very differently from at least for this season, since there's a good amount of water. Carson Jeffries is a field and lab director at the UC Davis Center for Watershed Sciences. And that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, email us at insight@capradio.org. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.